So, welcome to this six-week course on the design, construction, and addition to Villa Vuoto, which is my own house we're seeing here. It's an absolute pleasure to present this material to you. And I definitely look forward to any kind of questions or feedback that you might give me for the class. Anything that you see that I can do to improve it, definitely welcome. This is my fourth class teaching at Osher. Some of you might have been in some of the previous classes on Gaudi and Guastavino. The last one was the end of architecture. So my intent with this class here today is to kind of offer a master level survey of architecture from the perspective of a practicing architect myself. I've been practicing for a little over two decades now in residential architecture. In my own house that we're seeing here was designed and built from 2000. I started working on the design, and we moved in the August of 2004. So it's about 20 years old now. And as I mentioned, I try to stick with residential work. I do some work outside of residential work for some of my past residential clients occasionally when they ask, twist my arm. But I enjoy residential work because you're getting into a design that's really specified for a particular person or family that's going to be living in the space, and so you can really fine-tune it to those specific individuals, whereas all other type of architecture is not as intimate. This designing this space, for example, I can have a sense of a demographic of who's going to use this space or how it's going to be used, and you can get into a lot of detail with that. But with a house, you can really get in far deeper. And it's this personal aspect that really excites me about architecture, and so that's why I've kind of been fortunate to be able to just practice in that. And so with that, I thought presenting my own house, which is a little bit, feels a little awkward because putting it out there like that, but at the same time, you know, because it is my own house and because I'm talking about architecture from my perspective, I thought it was a way to kind of give you a little bit more of an insight into the way I see architecture, and so that's primarily the motive behind doing this. Like I said, for me, one of the thesis that I've kind of carried through my entire career is this idea that the home is the most intimate form of architecture, and in taking that even further, I believe that architecture is best conceived by the homeowner. And so a lot of the way that I set up my practice is try to not necessarily be in the traditional sense of a Frank Lloyd Wright, for example, the kind of the architect that delivers the house to the homeowner. I try to see myself more of a concierge, kind of guiding the homeowner through the process of creating their house, and kind of lending my expertise and my background and knowledge on the whole design construction process, but really kind of offer up to them my recommendations and kind of try to follow their lead. And more than that, I find it very exciting to try to, I see my task as trying to draw out from the particular homeowners the things that might be kind of buried down a little bit deeper within them that will create a house that will be most enjoyable for them to live in. And so you'll have to forgive me, I didn't bring a copy of the syllabus. I actually was planning to bring that today, but in the last hour I decided to change up a few things for next week's lecture, and so I wanted to update that before giving that out, so I'll definitely bring that with me next week. So I apologize, but I'll kind of give you a real brief overview of the class that we'll be getting into over the next six weeks. Today's lecture will be covering my own architectural education, just to kind of give you a little bit of a background of kind of where I'm coming from before I set out to do this. And that education was my undergraduate work at Ohio State University, And then my graduate work at Pratt Institute. Next week we'll be going into what I call my manifesto on architecture, which is a book that I wrote a few years after we completed the house and I had a chance to kind of live in the house and take it in and reflect on it after living in it a number of years. I ended up writing a book about the design behind the house, partly for my clients that would always ask me, you know, where did this thing come from? I could just kind of hand them the book. Also, I wrote it for my two sons, so that way when they get to be adults, they can have a little bit understanding of where the house they grew up in came from. And then I also wrote it for myself, because I continually, even today, go back and look at it, because it kind of like really laid out a lot of my ideas on architecture through kind of the lens of this house. I wanted to spend next week's lecture kind of presenting some of those ideas that were in that will give you, again, additional insights into where this came from. The third week, we'll get into the actual design of the house through drawings and models that I did in creating, coming up with the design. The fourth week, we'll cover the construction of the house, which was a two-year process from when we broke ground. The fifth week, we'll get into what I refer to as kind of the laboratory. I've been using the house. The house was, to some degree, it was created as a study. I wanted to make the point that we would, when my wife and I set out to have a family, I wanted to have the house complete so we could raise the kids in the house and have the house kind of influence their development as they were growing up. A lot of architects kind of in the 20th century designed their own houses, and some of them are really landmarks in architecture. But a lot of them didn't have the luxury of kind of doing that at the front end of their career. It kind of came at the tail end. My wife and I made the conscious decision when we moved back to Pittsburgh to really kind of do everything we could to bite the bullet and do this house before we had children, so that way we could kind of have that advantage of raising them. As a result, there's an ongoing experiment on seeing how that's going to, if it does have any impact on them as in development, growing up in a house like this. Both of them are college age right now, undergraduate school. In addition to that, the house has kind of spawned other things that I've kind of as a laboratory type setting, and I'll kind of present those in the fifth week. And then finally, the sixth week, I'm in the process right now, kind of just off screen here, the right hand side, there was a portion of the house that was in the original design, which we'll see in a couple weeks, but that was a room that was going to be used as a studio, home studio, where I would kind of work out of, my wife could work out of as well. Our kids could work on creating the things that they create. As we got into the house and started construction, like a lot of projects, we were well over budget. So we were looking for things to cut out. So we cut that out. A couple years ago, during the whole COVID lockdown, we decided to put it back in. And so we started work on an addition to put that room back into the house. And that's kind of an ongoing process. It's not complete yet. It's kind of a weekend project. The last lecture, I'll be kind of presenting the addition now kind of 20 years after the house was designed and built to see how the way I approach architecture, how it's changed from the way I saw it 20 years ago. Finally, one other thing I wanted to throw out there, if you're interested, after we kind of go through this journey, I'd like to welcome you out if you are interested in seeing the house in person, taking a tour. I'll try to either today or next week put out some dates to see what kind of date works best for everyone.
Where is it?
It's up in the North Hills. It's about a 15-20 minute drive from where we are now, up 279. Where 279 and 79 intersect, if you're familiar with the North Hills, which is the Wexford exit, Route 910. It's right off of that exit. Sits back, as you can tell from the photo here, sits back in the woods. but it's right in the middle of kind of suburban sprawl, which we'll get into a little bit next week.
When we talk about the problems with you might have with the municipality when you want to build something like this.
Oh, absolutely. So we probably could do an entire lecture just on that. But when we get into the design portion, and even the construction portion, we'll definitely be touching on that quite a bit. It's got some interesting stories to tell. So, as I mentioned, I did my undergraduate work at Ohio State University, receiving my Bachelor of Science in Architecture in 1991. And at that time, and tail end of the 80s and into the first part of the 90s, in architecture, there was this kind of trend at the time or interest in what was referred to as deconstructivist. Some of you may or may not be familiar with that term. And that kind of came out, a lot of the vigor for that kind of movement came out of a show that was mounted, an exhibition that was mounted at MoMA in 1988. By Philip Johnson and Mark Wigley. And that show, much like some of the other shows that Philip Johnson mounted at MoMA earlier in the century on modernism and a few others, really set kind of the current for architectural kind of discourse and discussion within the profession. But in particular, that show put a few people on the map, such as Zaha Hadid, as well as also Daniel Libeskind, which we're going to become intimately familiar with here ourselves in Pittsburgh very soon. But in addition to that, in that show included works by Frank Gehry, Rem Koolhaas, which is still today one of the kind of the leading speakers of architecture. But also in addition to that, there was about 10 individuals, but the one that really stood out that we're seeing here relative to Ohio State was Peter Eisenman. Peter Eisenman at the time was one of the kind of leaders in theory, kind of pushing the discussion on architecture at the time, and in particular deconstructivists. And we're seeing here this model design that he had for a center on Ohio State's campus. And these two existing buildings here are theaters, Mershon Auditorium here. This is, so just for reference, those of you that might be familiar with Columbus, this is North is Up, and this road right here is High Street. And so for those that are not familiar with Columbus, Columbus is really kind of two streets. It's North-South High Street and East-West Broad Street. And so the rest of the city is kind of laid out in a very traditional Jeffersonian grid. The topography in Columbus relative to Pittsburgh is one of the flattest cities in the country. And so because it's flat with almost no terrain to contend with, the lots were able to be laid out in this like almost purely abstract kind of geometry of this Jeffersonian grid. And so this grid Eisenman was taking with this design, and he was playing off of that a little bit. The campus of Ohio State, which is kind of left here on the left-hand side, this is actually, you can see the curvature here is kind of the large oval to the center of campus. And so, but the grid of campus is at an angle, askewed, about 12 and a quarter degrees from this grid of the city. And so he took these two grids that are at this angle, and he kind of superimposed the two together, and he used that superimposition of this grid to kind of inform the design of his building. His building primarily is this space here, this glass structure that fingers between the two theaters, and then comes out down on the lower side here, and then this is the entry into the to the center, which has kind of like this formal procession that arrives from High Street, which is kind of also the main corridor into campus. In addition to the fact that the Ohio State's kind of oval fronts in a very classical way towards this, and so he's kind of created as part of his design this grove of buckeye trees, which is kind of the state tree here, that kind of blocks off this vista that used to be here to High Street, and he's kind of skewed it now, and he brings the vista kind of into the entry of the Wexner Center. And so as you arrive, as you walk up this lane here, and before you get to the door entry here at this point, you get this cross-axial vista here that looks at 90 degrees, and here he's kind of hitting you over the head of this grid that he's creating, kind of in contrast to the grid of Columbus proper. So it's this fracturing that he's doing, but also, and here's again from High Street, kind of looking down this corridor to the front entryway. We're standing back here, looking here. High Street's over to the right. And you can see the main kind of portion of the building. He's also pulling apart the history of this lot, which used to have the armory, which was an older structure from the 1800s. And he's taken, he's recreating it because the armory at the time didn't exist. So he's kind of pulling it back from history. And he's also kind of layering it in different versions and variations, kind of almost handling it like a model, like a student's architectural model. But he's also peeling and slicing this apart, bringing some of this glass grid in through the space. And it's this fracturing that is kind of at the heart of this deconstruction that was behind this idea at the time. Of note, you can see here, again, off in the distance here, this is that main entryway here from High Street. And so, and here's the main building entrance on the left-hand side into the place. Off to the right-hand side, there's this recess pit that was filled in with broken glass in mounds here. This was an installation of artwork by Maya Lin, which was done in 1993, entitled Groundswell. I point this out. One of the things that always struck me about this particular installation is that this portion over here, this cement, has no railing, no kind of protection to prevent you from not only kind of this drop, which is roughly, I would say, 10 to 12 feet, but then once you fall those 10 to 12 feet, you're landing on broken glass. And so I always find it curious how they got away with not having to put this railing in. Was always curious. But it also, for me, in addition to what she was trying to say with her work, it kind of speaks to me and makes a statement about this idea of the building code, these kind of the safety and protection that the building code offers, this railing intended to prevent you from harm if you were to slip over on this side unintentionally. And so for me, this not only Maya's piece, but also Eisenman's building, the fact that he, I'm sure, worked very hard to keep that railing from being placed by the building commission. He also was there just recently, a couple months ago, and I had a chance to kind of go visit. Hadn't been there in some time, and so I was taking a few photographs, and I noticed some of the disrepair, and interestingly enough, just went through a huge multi-million dollar restoration not too long ago, a couple of years ago. And so I took note of some of the deterioration that's happening on the building, which I found kind of poetic, but I'm sure Eisenman's not too much a fan of. So Peter Eisenman, in addition to this, so one other point on the Wexner Center before we leave that. I was fortunate that when I came into Ohio State, they had just went through the process literally weeks prior to me arriving, where they had awarded Peter Eisenman the commission. It was a competition, kind of an invited competition of about half a dozen architects, very well known. And he landed the competition, so he was awarded it. Then he went through the first year or so of my, when I was in school, they refining the design, and then they broke ground. And so during my undergraduate time at Ohio State, I was fortunate not only kind of seeing that process through that eyes, because all of that was shared very much with the School of Architecture, but then also my walk to campus pass through this lot. And so I got to see the construction of this building go up. And so it was a great insight as a student to see just the construction process on a building. And then after it was completed, it was heralded as probably the most significant deconstructivist building in the world at the time. Still held up in much in that way. It was one of the first that not only cemented Eisenman, but just in general, that whole kind of movement. It's one of the best articulated. And so Eisenman was teaching studio at Ohio State at the time. And in addition to that, his kind of his right-hand man was this a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Kipnis. And both Kipnis and Eisenman were very heavy on theory, which was probably what I enjoyed most about Ohio State was this kind of theory approach to design. One of the things that they were kicking around at the time was this idea of weak form. Weak spelled W-E-A-K. Weak form was this idea where this kind of non-analytic design process where the architecture is so weak in design that it affords unexpected opportunities to kind of come out of the design that were not intended, as opposed to an architecture that's designed so rigid and so strong, in contrast, that it doesn't allow any kind of activity within the space of that structure other than what it was intended for. And so they were very much interested in trying to create this space that afforded these unexpected opportunities. So this is one of the projects that I worked on at the time when I was in their studio. And this was a culture center that was for a competition in Uzbekistan at the time. And it was this large open space that was going to provide for various things like a music hall, a museum. But aside from kind of like the forms and the spaces that I was creating over here, what appealed to them most, they liked most about my design was this large open kind of festival area space here that was between the existing residential district and the business district over here, and kind of this juxtaposition that created this open space where the two kind of overlap and interact created the opportunity for, again, these unexpected events. In fact, one of the terms they threw around was this concept of event structure as opposed to structured events. And so it was this idea of creating a structure that allows for, again, these unexpected opportunities. Here's a cross section through the design that I was working on. I also, one of the other studios that had a large impact on my studies was by a gentleman by the name of Frank Fantuzzi. And this was, at the time, a professor or a faculty member that had just graduated himself maybe 2 to 3 years prior to this class. So he still very much was of the mindset of a student. But they had this idea of what they termed a vertical studio that was off campus. This is actually south of downtown proper, is just north of above off screen here. But this was in what's referred to as kind of the brewery district. Very kind of similar to, I guess, what you think of maybe of the Strip here in Pittsburgh. But they had these warehouses, this building here in particular, that they were able to acquire, borrow for this studio, which was a 10-week studio. And they took in about a dozen of us that were in the class. And they gave us use of this building to pretty much explore design in real space. Rather than kind of design on paper or design with a model or drawing, this was the idea was where you're going to create architecture with the actual material of the building itself, kind of in situ. And so a lot of us explored various things within the building. We kind of, and now actually in retrospect, I'm surprised they got this building because we kind of tore it apart. Here we pulled some of the weights out of the windows that were used to counterbalance the windows operation. And I was primarily interested in trying to explore the intersection between body and structure, how the two kind of interact. in a physical way, but also even in a metaphysical way. And so here, a couple images of some of the contraptions that we hooked up with pulleys and weights, pulling your body across the floor in various ways. Here was an incident where I actually was lucky to survive. I had the mistake of putting the weight down this elevator shaft, and it pulled me across the floor, and then as I got to the end of it, I realized, you know, how am I going to get out of this? Kind of like a typical student, you know, doesn't think ahead, and there was nobody around. That's the other part about this class was great, because it was a 24/7, 7 days a week. We were there, like we lived in this space. And it was very much kind of a group kind of idea, where we would eat meals together, we'd prepare meals together. We had Friday night movie nights where our Frank Fontuzzi had this exceptional collection of short films, art short films. And this was all pre-internet. And so he literally brought out, you know, the film camera, and we would watch this, you know, this collection of these art house films on Friday nights with popcorn. But this particular moment, for some reason, I was the only one in the building. I was yelling out, and nobody came to my rescue. I got lucky; it slipped off my legs, and the weights went dropping four stories and crashed. But all of that kind of, which was more the physical side, much kind of what attracted me to Ohio State was this theoretical side that Kipnis and Eisman were pushing. And one of the things that happened by circumstance for me, which was probably the most interesting thing that I did in this 10 weeks from my professor's standpoint, was that as we would arrive to this building from campus, from our other classes that we'd be taking as well, we'd come back to this building, and this was the back of the building, the parking lot here, where we would park, and then we'd enter the building through this door down here. And so as you pulled up into the parking lot, you could very quickly see the cars that were parked, and even though we had this entire building in multiple floors, it was like something like 60,000 square feet, people could be all through it, and you might not see them for hours. But when you pulled into the lot, you knew immediately who was there, because you recognized their cars parked in the lot. So this one weekend, I had this wedding of a friend that I had to go to out of town, and I didn't tell my teacher, because he would have frowned on me leaving, and because he wanted complete dedication to the class. And so I drove to the place, I parked my car, and then I had my girlfriend at the time pick me up, and we went to the wedding. And so my car sat in the parking lot over the weekend. And it wasn't that I intended to try to fool anyone, but it was the most convenient place to meet her and leave my car, and we were to go. I get back the following week, and everybody was like wondering, where was I? Like they kept all the whole weekend, they were looking through the building to try to find me. And it almost kind of had this kind of Chris Burden type effect. But that turned out to be unintentionally probably one of the more effective events of the 10-week study. So also, in addition to these two classes, the other thing that had an impression on me in undergraduate school was I was always searching for this, what I couldn't find because it was so heavily theory-based, was a more practical way to study architectural form. And I didn't feel like at the time I was getting enough of that at Ohio State. There were no classes where they would teach you, this is how you handle form, this is how you work with form, this is how you design with form. And not to say that that was necessarily something that they should be teaching, but it was something that I kind of longed for and I wanted and I wasn't getting. And so part of that was I took many classes outside of the architecture curriculum within the art school. Here's an example of one of the drawings I did for a figure drawing class. But this kind of desire to kind of figure out how do you handle form as an architect, as a designer, is something that I carried through into my graduate work at Pratt, kind of seeking out, trying to find that to kind of add to my education. Along those lines, when I was looking at graduate schools to attend, one of the places that I learned from my history classes at Ohio State was in the Bauhaus in the 20th century. Very much was attracted to kind of like this idea or this approach that they were taking to how they were approaching design, which was breaking from kind of the tradition that was set up classically through like the Beaux-Arts, for example. And so Marcel Breuer, his chair that we're seeing here, he had taught this group of five architects at Harvard, back kind of teaching this Bauhaus kind of on the state side once it kind of moved mid-century. And one of his leading students was the name John Johansson, was teaching at the time at Pratt Institute. And so I kind of sought him out as close as I could kind of get to someone that kind of had a direct connection to this Bauhaus to kind of teach me some of what this Bauhaus had to offer. And in addition to that, so here's one of his houses, one of his more well-known houses that he had designed. This is referred to as his foam house, which was a sprayed kind of gunite concrete that would be sprayed onto a wire mesh form to kind of create these very organic shapes and forms. This was back in 1954 when he was proposing this. He was one of the first to kind of propose this idea of this gunite type construction technique. In addition to finding him at Pratt, I also had a teacher by the name of Deborah Gans, who at the time was the head of the undergraduate school. She taught theory. She taught kind of the history and theory at Pratt at the time. And so very much like I did at Ohio State, I kind of gravitated to her class. And one of the assignments that she gave me in her class was a writing assignment where we were looking at the work of Kant and Hegel and this theory on dialectics that they deal with in their works. And we had to write what's referred to as a scientific autobiography. And in that writing, I created this piece. It was called Mousetrap. And this was back in 93. I've since kind of recently, actually in 2016, not too long ago, I came across this when I was cleaning out the house. And I took it upon myself kind of now, you know, decades later, giving myself the same assignment again and rewriting the piece again and seeing how that might differ from the one that I wrote when I was in graduate school. And so I did that. And I kind of found myself exploring this idea of insideness, which I want to read just a short excerpt here from that that kind of speaks on that, where intuition relates objects immediately, affecting the mind in a specific manner by means of sensibility. All thinking, whether it does so directly or indirectly, must ultimately relate to intuitions. For no object can be given to us in any other way. And so it's this idea of these intuitions that we find ourselves kind of driven by. We make our decisions, our behavior is kind of driven by these things, but because they're intuitions, we kind of like push them down. Our rational, reasoned mind is thinking about things more concretely, more directly. And these intuitions, a lot of times, if you're not paying attention to them, you can kind of like miss them. And you know, some people spend quite a bit of their time really focused on them and trying to kind of like make their decisions and actions on these intuitive things. But I've always found it kind of interesting, this dialectic between kind of this intuitive side and this more rationed reason side, and how these two things kind of mix and mesh, sometimes get in the way of each other and ultimately end up with the actions that we have, you know, which can become very complicated because of this kind of interaction that's occurring. In addition to these two individuals at Pratt, probably the one of the main reasons that I selected Pratt at the time was a result of these three individuals here. This gentleman here by the name of Alexander Costello. He was an Iranian-born student that studied in Paris and at the University of Berlin in philosophy and psychology. But he also taught painting at Kansas City Art Institute. back in the 20s. This was 1922. One of his classes, he had a student by the name of Rowena Reed. And the two of them met, fell in love, ended up marrying. And the two of them, in 22, after marrying, he got a job here back at Carnegie Tech Institute in 1929. So the two of them found themselves coming back here to Pittsburgh. Rowena at the time taught sculpture. He taught a painting class here at Carnegie Tech. But the two of them developed this this concept of a structured language for understanding and teaching the visual arts. And so they were very much also kind of like my search for form. They were trying to search for a pedagogy of art and visual arts that was missing, they felt. When he studied classically painting over in Europe, it was kind of ad hoc in his sense. There wasn't kind of like a rigor and kind of like a method that was kind of taught. And so this was something that he and Rowena were developing while they were at Carnegie Mellon. They also got in contact with a third gentleman by the name of Donald Doner, which taught at Carnegie Tech at the time. But he was coming from a very practical side when he was teaching here. He taught, he also worked at Westinghouse at the time and was developing some of Westinghouse's new materials and plastics. And so he was bringing kind of like his practical expertise from the industry side into Carnegie Tech and trying to meld that into the art program and to kind of get this mix between the art and industry. And so when he, as he was doing this and as Alexander came, arrived here to Pittsburgh and saw kind of this interaction, this was interesting to him and he saw an opportunity to really create an entire program within the art school that kind of bridged this gap between industry and design and art. And so they went and proposed this to the school, and in 1934, they created the first industrial design program in the world at Carnegie Mellon, or Carnegie Tech at the time. Their first graduates came out in 1936. And so it was this idea of, again, industrial design. It was the marriage of these two things, this industrial practical side of business, industry that was coming out of this industrial revolution that happened in the late 1800s, mid-1800s, and now found its way into the academic world through Carnegie Tech. So in 36, the same year that they kind of put out their first graduates, Doner was invited to Pratt Institute to open a program there. So then Pratt subsequently had the second program in the country, industrial design program. He brought along Alexander and Rowena with him. So the three of them kind of developed this curriculum at Pratt, and they refined it even further than kind of what they were doing at Carnegie Tech, where Doner focused very much on the practical industrial side. Alexander focused on the theory, the philosophy of design, and Rowena, her specialty was again in this sculptural kind of abstract approach. And so this abstraction of sculpture and really trying to seek out three-dimensional form is what I was kind of looking for when as I approached into graduate school that I thought was missing. And so through the three of them, through this industrial program, but more specifically Rowena, as she developed this over her 50-year career of teaching at Pratt, she developed what's referred to today as the foundation curriculum that you have in design schools all across the world. The first year of design, this foundation series is something that the three of them kind of developed mostly, she kind of had her hand in.
Didn't that start at the Bauhaus?
So that's right. So during this time period, great segue. The Bauhaus, Mies van der Rohe was, as I mentioned earlier, with Breuer at Harvard, but also Mies out in Chicago at the Chicago Institute. Was bringing kind of what he referred to as the new Bauhaus. He kind of went shut down in Germany after he fled and came here. They were starting, and so he was teaching directly straight out of what he was teaching in Germany, which was a little bit different than what Rowena was teaching, but a lot of their concepts were drawn directly from the Bauhaus, without a doubt. In particular, The, falling behind here a little bit. Here's a catalog here from Carnegie Institute Tech, their industrial design program that they were showing the objective and approach. And then here's Pratt, the main building on campus here when they brought it to school there. This is Alexander here on the left and Rowena here on the right. Again, what they refer to as this foundation course. And you can see here, they made it as a prerequisite within the departments of advertising, illustration, industrial design, interior design. But it was this idea of trying to create that in that first year, bring the students in and give them, again, a foundation to these core concepts of design that could be applied across all these other design fields. And subsequently, it became very popular and spread like wildfire through, here's a few lists of some of the first generation of students that came out of that program that then subsequently headed up programs elsewhere in, around the country. In particular, Rhode Island School of Design, as well as Cornell, Stanford, which also, I didn't realize until I was preparing for this course, one of the other one, Columbus College of Art and Design. When I was a high school student back in Columbus, I took a couple summer classes at Columbus. And as I looked thought back about it, it dawned on me, there was kind of like this Bauhaus kind of, you know, industrial design approach to the way they kind of taught their summer classes. And so it made sense when I kind of came across that. But this foundation concept, she was teaching these ideas of studying form. In this case here, example of line and space. This is with wire, three-dimensionally, kind of defining a linear profile in three-dimensional form and space. Here, this is a planar problem where they take planes, and again, they also are designing these and shaping them three-dimensionally in space. And this is all trying to study and understand the essence and the markers that are creating sculptural design three-dimensionally. To your point, here's the Bauhaus that Mies was doing over at the same time over in Chicago. Here's an example of some of their studio, the students in studio here at their workstations. And over on the left-hand side, you can see some of the stuff they are promoting for their new Bauhaus. But interestingly enough, Mies was very much interested in architecture as kind of like, and he felt like all of the other arts should kind of come from architecture as opposed to kind of the reverse. And so his new Bauhaus in Chicago was very heavy in that approach, which was a distinction. And also, interestingly enough, Rowena always commented, because there was a little bit of a back and forth kind of professional feud between the two of them trying to kind of establish these new programs, this new concept. And one of the critiques that she made of his kind of approach through this new Bauhaus was they didn't really understand space. They were designing more form and kind of formally, but the way she approached her form was to look more at the space to kind of inform the form, something that referred to as like negative space you might be familiar with, looking at the space that kind of informs and drives these things. So in addition to this, they were much like here at Carnegie Tech. Donor was bringing in the practical side here was with GM. Out of Detroit, they were bringing in some of these professionals into their program. They went even a step further to where at Pratt, they created office space within the schools, design schools, and they gave these office space over to these individuals that were coming from GM, for example, from his design within commercial side, coming in and doing work within these office spaces within the schools of art, design. So that way, they could interact with the students at the same time and kind of like feed off of each other, cross-pollinate. And as a result of this, many of their students, when they came out, were hired directly into these companies. And there was dozens of them at the time in various industries. We can see some of this boats, auto, furniture, kitchen utensils, appliances, all these kind of machine-made products that were this kind of industrial, and a lot of this was the industries, these manufacturing that was happening, that was coming and transforming the way things were being made, kind of in this industrial setting, they felt like there was a need for these designers to approach it from an artistic perspective, to create an appliance that has a visual aesthetic to it, not just a functional engineering that was coming out of these products prior to Pratt and Carnegie Tech kind of applying the design to these products. And they recognized that by doing so, it made the products more marketable when they went to sale. And so kind of along those lines, here in 1955, Rowena and Alexander were invited to up to Michigan with General Motors and Frigidaire to design the kitchen of the future. And so this was one of their designs that came up. This is in 55. Here's the installation of the work. And so again, it was this really kind of marriage of design and industry together. So this is a picture here of Rowena. I wanted to, before we take a short break here, point out one thing where she, again, this kind of like little dialogue that she had with Mies in particular, but in general, this idea of architecture, design, as compared to industrial design, and trying to kind of define the distinction between the two and how the two are handled differently. And that's also partly what brought me to Pratt as a graduate student, was because when I saw the way that the industrial design department was approaching design of these physical forms, it was a very different method from the way that the architecture schools were teaching design of physical forms. And even though the forms might be different, designing a building versus designing an appliance or designing a car, the fact that you're still designing a three-dimensional object, there was clearly an overlap there. And in fact, actually, as you saw here with the kitchen of the future, there was many cases where in the industrial design program, they were dabbling in architecture and they were designing architectural space. And so one of the, I'll cite an example here where this kind of well-known story within the Pratt program with Rowena, where she had come across one of these students in her class that was doing all of his design work on drawings, two-dimensional drawings. And she you know, stopped him in the middle of one of these sessions and she says, "Are you drawing?" And he kind of looked at her a little intimidated and he said, "Yeah." And she's like, "What did you study here before you came to my class?" And so then he explained that he was from the architecture school at Pratt. And he was taking her class to, again, much the same way that I approached it, to try to learn design from her perspective. And so then she said, "Well, that's the way the architecture profession works, and it's wrong. You must learn how to think directly in three dimensions. If you know how to organize in space three-dimensionally, you can learn how to draw three-dimensionally, but it's not the way to design." And so for her, like these three-dimensional objects or space kind of like handles, is dealing with this idea of depth. And depth is really what sets three dimensions apart from two dimensions. And so this idea of depth in a photograph that we're seeing here is flat, or even in a drawing is flat, but only in a three-dimensional form, in model form, three-dimensionally when you're designing, can you deal with depth directly. And so designing kind of two-dimensionally in a drawing form or in a photograph here, or even today, this was, you know, much later after Rowena, but today on a computer screen that's two-dimensional, there's a limitation there. And so she said that there's things that designing three-dimensionally, you can't be created on a piece of paper. And that was kind of like one of her mantras that she recited frequently to her students, saying that you have to deal with this negative space that comes with three dimensions, and you have to deal with that directly. So with that, we'll take a quick 10-minute, maybe 5-minute break, because we're running a little bit over, if that's all right.
So you started talking about deconstruction, and then you moved to kind of forms and shapes. Is there a connection, or are they just kind of at odds? How do you see that?
There is a connection, but deconstruction, as I mentioned, like with Eisenman and Kipnis, it was much more theory heavy. The ideas that a lot of the ideas behind deconstruction were coming out of these French writers like Derrida, and which was dealing more with kind of philosophy more than architecture, but they were kind of like drawing from his philosophical writings, and then they were kind of applying it to architecture. And so their ideas of design and form was, because it was coming from this more theoretical base, which is kind of conceptual, less kind of tangible from a physical stance. It's not, as an example, we saw at the Wexner Center with this kind of like armory, the relic, and the grid, three-dimensional grid. Those are very strong visual forms, but they're very heavily loaded with ideas behind them. And you can see, you know, when you see that armory, you kind of see all these layers of brick kind of peeled away, you can say there's something going on here. I'm not too sure what it is, you know, unless I kind of go find out, you know, a little plaque that explains it. But you can tell intuitively that there's something more than just on the surface happening there. And so that was, you know, that was a handling, which Eisenman was teaching, that was a handling of form that was more kind of about the narrative, the story, the ideas, the concepts, more so than the physical aspects that we're going to get in here in the second half, which Rowena was dealing with, which is looking at, which is also kind of practical to some degree as far as like dealing with light, shadow, and these types of things. But that was something that wasn't, you know, discussed as much in Kipnis's and Eisenman's kind of studios.
It's nice to do it in person because the other classes I've taken for you have been online.
I know. I love it in person. It's like, I teach in the similar program over at Pitt, and they're still kind of, well, they're doing both, but they, last few of my classes have been online, and so
most of classes are online now.
Yeah, yeah.
Pitt?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't
know.
There's an apprehension to, ever since COVID, to kind of come back in person, I think, to some degree.
And they've had some issues. I know they've had some changes in the program, but I've heard they're mostly online now.
Right? Yeah.
Actually, Mies didn't have anything to do with the new Bauhaus in Chicago. It was run by Moholy Nagy and then Gregory Kepich.
Right.
Mies ended up teaching architecture at IIT.
Right.
But that was much later.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. They started the program there. I kind of errantly left them out. But from like the architectural perspective, that's kind of why I was mentioning Mies, but you're 100% right.
Right.
Yeah. No, they definitely set that program up over there.
Yeah, and the war killed it.
Yeah, much like it did over there.
Well, it's interesting, you know, they were sponsored by the Chicago Manufacturers Association.
Exactly.
And they gave a show at the end of the first year.
Right.
And the guys went there and there was nothing there that had anything to do with manufacturing anything.
Right.
They cut their funding.
Right.
It's you guys aren't doing anything for us.
Yeah, right, exactly.
It's very interesting.
Right. Yeah. And I kind of get the sense that he had a similar experience over in Germany. Like it was, you know, he didn't really kind of like deliver on some of the stuff they were selling.
Absolutely. That's why
they kind of Hitler shut it down.
The first city shut him down.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah.
Theory, but I guess you'll get that. That's
reality.
Right. That's right. Exactly. You'll get that with strong-headed people.
Yeah, you do.
Right.
I love the Gowdy
class, by the way.
Thank you so much. I mean,
I
love it too. I mean, he's at the top of my list, so
I was very disappointed that you canceled your trip.
I didn't cancel it. In fact, we're trying to resurrect it, and we're very close, very close. It was supposed to happen this fall.
It was through Pitt.
That's through Pitt, that's right.
You should do it through CMU.
I know, well, maybe I can get them to go. But, yeah, we were slated to get it resurrected for this fall, and unfortunately, the legal department's not playing nice with us, and so it's a little bit more cumbersome. But we're on track for the spring of next year, and we'll see, fingers crossed. But yeah, I would love to take one from CMU. Because he's, like I said, there's no one in my mind.
And what is his trip? Gary to
Barcelona.
Barcelona?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
In addition to, after spending most of the time in Barcelona, a little skirt over to Bilbao because we're so close to see Guggenheim.
You can go there and see yourself.
Yes.
To have a tour guide.
Yes.
No, I would love to present it. I could talk endlessly about Gaudi's work.
So we'll talk about it for CMU.
Absolutely. I would take any help you can get with
on it. Just on the curriculum committee, so we'll talk.
Awesome. So let me get back into this. We were running a little bit over, and the second half is actually a little bit, from my perspective, a little bit more exciting than the first half. I'm going to give you kind of a little sampling of the way Rowena approached this design that we were talking about here in this foundational program that she was pitching. And I'm going to give you three real quick examples of some of these. What she referred to as experiences was the way she kind of approached them. She had these exercises that she would have the students go through that she termed these experiences. And so first one I'm going to do here real quickly is I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, and with your eyes closed I want you to physically sense the positions of your two hands and consider how the two differ, your right from your left. And really kind of like try to feel, you know, that position of your fingers and your wrists and your hand positions. And so once you do that, you can open your eyes back up. This idea of your hands as well as your whole body has these nerves and these with kind of neurons that are tangled up within your tendons and your muscles, and it's this ability for your body to, through these neurons that are tangled up at, you know, the various positions your muscles and tendons and joints will be in, it can sense and physically feel those positions, and that's necessary for your body to be able to function, just be able to kind of not only kind of hold its position, but to be able to kind of move through space, because, you know, you can't take a step without kind of knowing where your foot is at. And so this stuff is happening subconsciously, kind of sub or below the conscious level, because as you can imagine, you know, your body's got many different joints and parts and pieces. And so if you're having to physically concentrate on that consciously, it would be very distracting. You wouldn't be able to walk and chew gum. And so all of these things are happening kind of subconscious, but nevertheless, it's happening. And when you take the time and you actually focus on it, you can sense it, and you can be aware of those sensations. So that's one of the things, one way to kind of like get the students starting to kind of like recognize what you're focusing your senses are on, what you're trying to focus your attention on, so you can be kind of taking this next step, which is this second experience, which I'll kind of give you a little bit of a demonstration here. You can do this after class if you'd like, but you'd have this thing where you would start outside of a room, like we're doing here, and then as I walk into the room, at this point right here, I'm kind of like not outside the room, not inside the room, I'm like right in between, kind of like this threshold, this envelope where I'm entering the room. And I can sense this, even if I'm not, again, consciously trying to pay attention to this, but I'm sensing this intuitively, subconsciously. These same kind of neurons that are sensing the position of my hands, I've also got those neurons all through my body, And they're going out from my body and they're sensing things around me, such as acoustically, as I'm talking right now, I can hear it bouncing off of these threshold here in the door. But in addition to acoustically, my skin's picking up thermals. So like this being metal, it's colder. I can intuitively, as I pass through, I can feel it get slightly colder, and then it gets warmed up as I'm inside the room. And so these whole myriad of different things, these currents that are in the space, is differentiated from here to right here to right here. And so that kind of segregate from one to the other is drawing attention to this this idea of threshold, to where space, as you get into Rowena's class, you're going to get into all these aspects of space. But at its basic core, space is first defined by this kind of threshold envelope, the perimeters of the space is defined by this room that we're inhabiting together right here. And so then finally, get to this third experience, which this was what I then studied myself in my graduate studies. Some of you might saw in the thesis that was circulating around here before the class. These are some images that were taken from the studies that I was doing in preparation for my thesis at school. And also I'll mention, I might have skipped over this. Actually, no, we're good. So this idea of studying form three-dimensionally in model form, these are some scale models that were created for my thesis. And Rowena had this idea of always creating two identical models when you were studying a physical form. One was a control model and one was the design model. So very much like in a kind of a medical study, you have this control model that's gonna remain unchanged. So that way you can visually, as you're working on this model down here and you're manipulating it, you have something to compare it to three-dimensionally to see the various things. And so this control model becomes labeled the original condition. And then as you manipulate the design model, in this case here, this plane here on the left-hand side is moved, you get variation from the original condition. And so it was very much this taking the models and working through various different variations. And as you're working through these variations, you're doing these exercises like we just had with your hands in the door, where you're focusing on the sensational differences within the form and the space in the model. You're paying very close attention to how the perception of this space sensually changes by moving one of these elements, for example. And also I'll point out, she had this kind of like tripartite approach, to where you would start off in the work with like the first piece, whatever this object is that you're studying, there was what was referred to as the dominant form, which is the one here on the right-hand side. Then there was a subdominant, a secondary form that we're seeing here on the left-hand side. And then there was a subordinate form, which was a third one. And so the subdominant and the dominant two were very much kind of like these pairs that were kind of like playing off of each other. And then as the name implies, the subordinate was dependent on these two others. And so you would take this first dominant form and you place this without these other forms there. And this first one is kind of setting the context. You have this square space that I'm looking and studying. By putting down this first form, it's kind of defining the characteristics of the space. It's putting this large space here on the left-hand side. It's segregating off this right-hand side, a portion away from it. But it's creating the context and the environment that these other two forms are going to play in. And by extension, as the second subdominant form comes in, it's now about a dialogue and a relationship that's happening between these two forms. And by moving it around, that conversation is changing. And so we can see here, going from down on the lower slide, going from this first movement change, you see it moving in slightly. This is what's referred to as an improved, taking this first variation. I'm trying to by sensing the space, I'm trying to find what position does it want to be in where the space is improved, the sense of space has been improved. One of the things that she was trying to get you to focus on within the object and the forms was this idea of negative space. And this was also going back to before the break, this was kind of her critique of Mies, that they were dealing with form, they didn't really understand what space was about. Some of you also might be familiar with Wright pointed this out at one point where he made the acknowledgement, actually surprisingly, well into his career, where he came to the realization that architecture is not about the form, it's about the space that the forms create. And so this is very much what Rowena was trying to teach as well. But along those lines, the task that was set out with this was to try to create a negative space from the original condition that expands to become the most activated negative space that you can create. So the goal is to try to take the space that's negative here and make it more lively, more active, expanding to include as much as this platform as possible is the goal. And so from this first variation on the left-hand side to this one, pulling that subdominant form in slightly, seeing to make the space more active, negative space, because you see the space that's behind this is kind of lost, much like this space is kind of lost, it's not kind of in play. These three forms are kind of talking about this space in here, and so by pulling it in, it enlarges this space, tightens this space, and it brings this into the conversation. It's kind of expanding that negative space into the dialogue. And then finally, the subordinate form here, even a more subtle movement, you can see on the bottom, where it gets pulled a little, sorry about that. Try to erase that from your mind. You can see it being pulled in slightly to this form that is engaging it. Now this is kind of like pulled into the conversation, and now this is kind of engaging, interacting with this in a dialogue. And so that that dialogue is now creating the space around it, the tension that's happening between them. But it activates this space, it activates this space. This space has been activated, so all of this has been activated by just the movements of these two pieces relative to the original condition.
So is that why Frank Lloyd Wright has tiny entries and low ceilings?
Exactly, right. He's playing with the same concepts of compression and release, even more the vantage point. I'm drawing a blank on the term that he used. Having, much like in the Roby House in Chicago, having this view from the top that looks out across the prairie but maintains the privacy from the street looking back into the space. And so it was this kind of advantaged view. All this type of stuff is exactly what Wright was exploring as well. So that was kind of like the foundation when I got to Pratt for my thesis, that I was studying this approach that Rowena was teaching on three-dimensional form. But then what was missing from that in the model three-dimensional form is the body. Much like we were talking about her examples with the muscles and the joints, and the fact that when I walk through the room and I'm perceiving the thresholds of the space, I'm taking that in through my body, the senses of my body. And so without the body being part of that, there's no way to take in the space that you're perceiving, because it's all kind of filtered or biased by my perspective through my body. And so these were a couple images that I was using to kind of make this point in my research of a standing figure and kind of like the implications, aside from the political aspect, but the physical implications of a standing figure versus a reclining figure, and how the difference between standing and lying, and how those differences change your perspective of the space that you're inhabiting. This gentleman's perspective of the space is very different from this guy's perspective of the space that they're in. just by the position that their bodies are in at the time. So took that to these model studies and put in a scale figure that's kind of representative of trying to now not only just like look at the space abstractly like we looked in the previous slides, but in this case, I'm now trying to envision this sense of space from the perspective of this position of the scale figure. And how, again, this original condition pushes the wall back a little bit, creates a little bit more space, a little bit more breathing room. This would be seen as an improved condition because it's, again, in Rorina's terms, it's expanding the negative space to be more beneficial for this individual that's in this position down here. Looking at the same space that I've improved, now the person moves to the back behind the wall. And so that this space is very different from that perspective. And so then as a result, the wall kind of moves forward to kind of open up the space back here when you're standing in the backside. If you enter in both people at the same time, now you can actually look at this and say, okay, where's a happy medium? Where's a balance point? Where is this wall wanting to gravitate towards to be its most effective position for both those vantage points? And so then it shifts slightly and becomes kind of this improved position. So then this was taken to after doing these studies, which also I'll mention, because I did errantly skip over this, Martin Skalski was the at the time that I was there, he was the teacher in the transportation design portion of the industrial design school. And so even though I was enrolling within the School of Architecture for my graduate work, I took my thesis, I did my research within the industrial design program. Because again, I was trying to learn how these industrial designers approach design in contrast to architects within the architecture program. And so Martin was my thesis advisor. He was the one that kind of guided me through these techniques that I showed you. And he drew those from when he was a student under Rowena. She stopped teaching in 1986. He had her for class when he was a student at Pratt. And so he very, very faithfully approaches his transportation design in the same vein of what she taught. And in particular, he was much like that earlier photo that we saw with GM. Most of Detroit would come to his class in particular and take his students because at the time that I was there, he was producing the most talented designers within the automotive industry. And so I very much was interested in seeing you know, what is he doing with the design of these cars and trucks that enables them to be so successful and so sought out? Can that be applied to architecture as well? And so so he kind of took me through this. I took these four studies that we were doing in the previous slides, and I created in the lobby to the main building that we saw earlier. This is the entrance here on the left-hand side. There's a gallery space over here that shows student work. It's kind of revolving. There's an elevator here on the right-hand side that takes you up five or six floors. And then opposite of the photograph is the president's office for the university or the institute. And so this entryway that I selected as kind of my site for my installation, I was going to create a physical installation of forms and study those forms and how they affect the use of that space, taking what I was learning in model form and apply it to an actual physical built structure. And so I selected this lobby space entering the press so I could kind of be assured that the president would walk through here daily and kind of be forced to kind of like engage with my work. But also, it was a great space to study because it was this transitional space. There was a lot of movement that was going through, and no one kind of hung out in this lobby. It was very cold and kind of like functional lobby. You came in the door, you either go into the gallery, you're going to the office, or you're going to the elevator to go upstairs. And so it was an opportunity to kind of study this this part of architecture, which is this circulation part. It's like it's not studying kind of like this room where we come and we sit to take in a class. It's this kind of circulation that is often kind of overlooked by architects as an opportunity to really study and explore.
That one point that's coming down, it's like in front of the door, was that the intention to get people to go around it?
Perfect. So we're going to get into that here in about 5 minutes, if you can hold off. This, so I created, in model form, I studied four forms. You can see some close-ups here of one form, two form, three, and then there's also one off camera. But I studied the model form for a period of time, worked through a design that I thought worked with the space, applying kind of like this approach to kind of create this improved condition spatially, as improved as I could make it. And then I was going to install it and see if it actually delivered by taking kind of measured scientifically kind of approach to the behavior of the people coming through the space. And so the forms were very simple, just steel bar that was welded kind of in these profiles, but then lath kind of wire tied to it. But it was also, the material was handled very much the same way that Rowena would handle these studies, like when she was doing these line form studies in space three-dimensionally. So it was almost kind of like taking her studies and just explaining them up in scale to full scale that you can actually inhabit kind of this model was the approach. She was also very fond, I'll point out, in her models, she liked to have the forms that you're studying float as opposed to be anchored to the floor, because when they're anchored to the floor, now you're engaged with the floor. The floor's got a dialogue that's happening. So she very, you know, some of those models that we saw earlier, they're kind of suspended in space. And so I took the same approach to these forms. They were all kind of suspended and floating off of the floor plane. So that way they were just involving more kind of an abstract spatial approach. If we take a look at the floor plan, here's the main entry here on the bottom. The gallery's over on the left, president's office on the right. There's an elevator here straight ahead. There's also two sets of stairs. One that goes up, one goes down. So we see here this larger form that was overhead. This was the dominant form that kind of was the first form placed that defined the space, kind of this canopy overhead. Then this subdominant form that was over the main entryway, and the two of these kind of playing off of each other, lapping and overlapping, really kind of defining the threshold that you pass as you come in the door, much like I was doing here. Once you step in from outside through this threshold, now you're into the lobby. These two forms were kind of accentuating that threshold, so that way, if you didn't notice it before, now you're going to notice it more likely. A third form, which is a piece which was kind of hanging on the corner of the elevator, and then a fourth form here down in the corner over here. These were then subordinate forms. This form is kind of subordinate to these two, as well as this one here. So I had two subordinate forms that were also kind of in a small, more subtle dialogue between the two of them. So over a period of time, several weeks, I sat outside. I had a video camera, and I videotaped the people coming and going for hours. And then I went back and I watched these videotapes, and I tracked the movement through the space. And as you can tell, the vast majority of the movement was going up or down the stairs or to the president's office, much less to the gallery. And then I took these forms and I then manipulated them. Over on the left-hand side, we see the installed condition. This is the dominant form on top, the larger one, and then the smaller subdominant form, which was just below it. They're suspended from cables from the ceiling. This gap right here was about 6 inches. And then I did an improved condition where I dropped this one down another 6 inches. So now it's 12 inches down from the dominant form above, which stayed in its same position. And so I was wanting to see, by lowering this piece 6 inches, does that have an impact on the movement? Is that something that people are, you know, they'll notice these forms as they walk in? but they're subconsciously, their body is responding to them because they're probably not taking in too much attention as they're hurrying past to their place. I also, the other piece that I moved in space was this other subordinate form, just to see, in addition to the subdominant one, whether the subordinate movement had any impact. So this one, in the original installed condition, and actually you can see here by the posters on the wall, you can kind of see it much easier. This one was dropped 8 inches down lower in the improved condition. And so, in addition to the movement studies, what was actually more effective was the stationary points that I logged. This is a before the forms were installed. I studied kind of the use of the space for many weeks just to see how the movement was occurring. But these dots here represent a place that someone would come as they're moving around and they would stop movement for whatever reason. 90% of these were people that had pushed the elevator button and they're waiting for the elevator to arrive. And so as they're waiting for the elevator to arrive, they're kind of nervously, you know, pacing. Maybe they, you know, come over to the door, they stop, they're looking out. But anytime their movement would stop, I put a point. And so you can see, you know, the majority of them are kind of by the elevator button, but you can see that they also, you know, there was some movement kind of working around here, down towards the front. This was before the forms went in. Then the forms went in, and so you can see the difference between the two. And then once the forms went in, again, I took this subdominant form here, dropped it 6 inches, took this one, dropped it 8 inches, and you can see the changes from that position to the improved condition. And so, interestingly enough, you can see a concentration gets a little bit tighter by dropping this down. It took some of the movement that was happening here and it pushed them forward. It was essentially what I surmised. And I think it's because as this dropped that 6 inches, it got very close to kind of head height. I intentionally kept it above 6 foot because I didn't want people bumping into it, getting in trouble from the president. And so, but I wanted it low enough to where if you weren't paying attention, you might do this because you're, as you're walking past. And so I think, you know, that leading point dropping down took some of this activity and it kind of scared them off. And so then interestingly enough, just by taking these forms, by designing the space to where you're trying to affect the behavior and the use of the space, you can kind of, just by these slight manipulations, you can push this activity of waiting on the elevator up here. So then that earlier slide that we saw with the circulation paths, as people came through, it's not a situation where you have to kind of like walk around somebody that's in the way. Because you're kind of like, you know, corralling them out of the way of this other circulation that's happening kind of this way and this way. And so there's a way to kind of take architecture through the design of interventions, controlling a more desirable outcome for the use of the space by making this behavior more efficient because you've corralled these people waiting on the elevator to stay up here out of the way of the front door, just by the physical design of the space.
Another question?
Yeah.
Did you actually do the welding and the cutting of the wood and the wrapping?
I did everything but the welding. I had my roommate was studying welding, so he offered to teach me to weld.
You're intimately involved.
Absolutely, yeah. So everything else other than the welding, I shaped the bars, the forms. He just basically tacked them for me, and then after that, I hung them and everything else to wrap the lath. Great question. One of the interesting things is as I was presenting this for my thesis in the review, final review, there was quite a bit of discussion. It was very lively discussion. But one of the takeaways that was not anticipated, at least from my perspective, there was quite a bit of time that was spent between some of the people on my review getting in a heated dialogue between each other on this idea of architecture and the design of architecture being approached as a science, to where you can study the design of form in a very scientific method, and approaching design from this scientific method, versus the kind of pre-industrial era when design was more of an intuitive-based design from like a humanist perspective. The way that the architecture that we're familiar with, that's kind of heralded in the history books as being great examples of architecture, were approached more from this intuitive-based design, much like a Frank Lloyd Wright you would think of, the way he kind of approached design very intuitively, as opposed to scientifically. And so at this time, during this whole kind of industrial mid-century, late-century approach, this much the same way they were bringing industry into design, they were also bringing the scientific method into design, and they were applying that. There were studies, like we saw the Kitchen of the Future. There was these studies where they looked at how the kitchen could be designed to be more efficient, more functionally usable, and applied very much the same way I did with this entry lobby, these kind of like studies of watching and seeing and learning from that. And so this heated debate happened where they fell into two camps, and the faculty was debating, you know, what should architecture be? I mean, is this the direction we want architecture to go? I mean, or should, are we losing some of the humanist approach to architecture by kind of following blindly down this kind of industrial scientific thing that's come upon us the last couple centuries? Yeah.
I'm confused. You say there are three different movement patterns. Why isn't there a movement pattern to the elevator button?
Yeah, that's a good point. So I left those off just to study these. So these patterns were people that spent no time in the lobby. They just were passing through. And so I didn't want those movements to kind of cloud this. And I did record those, but I don't have them on this drawing here. And so this was just to illustrate more clearly the movements that were coming through the space in contrast to those dots showing the people that spent time in the space. So we just have a couple minutes here. I want to read through something I wrote. If you'll bear with me, a couple years ago when I was reflecting on, again, this education, this study of proximics, which is, if I had to put one word on it, was kind of trying to understand these proximic relationships of the body and the occupant within a space, and how there's this dialogue that's happening through proximics, the distances, how the physical form affects the use in the space in this proximic way. And so I wrote this thing a couple years ago, talking and trying to summarize in my own mind the way I kind of see proximic in relationship to architecture. So sunlight filtered by alto stratus, the day feels heavy, a seriousness, as if conditions are inescapable today. The star that warms is kept at a distance, chill from a damp wind has taken precedent. Sun is no further than yesterday, yet strength is diminished by the blanket of clouds. Yesterday, the sky was a deep blue sea, no clouds to be found. Tree-top branches were bare, fissures at the edges, terra taking hold of a crisp, clear, invisible air. A kitchen window is open somewhere, out of sight. At the distance, a fresh baked pie can flavor a lingering breeze with the taste of cherries. On the same air, vibrations are carried of a string instrument practicing sweets, sharps and flats, striating the backdrop overhead. We are sensuous creatures in a world layered by multitude of channels, uniquely blended by each person into an impression, resonating with meaning from their lives in that moment, in that place. The universe is not universal, it's subjective, taken in by each subject on a case-by-case basis. In our case, on this earth, it is through this light, sound, smell, traversed through the air, water, and land. It's not magic, but it can become magical. When a ball of fire in the sky, the one energizing our body and mind daily, stops time to fill our soul as it touches the horizon, setting skies ablaze. This is the language we speak. Words are felt, not spoken. The unspoken carrying more weight than all the articulation otherwise, because it's immediate, nearly simultaneous. A place cannot be void without feeling, the substance which permeates all things. Without proximity, there would be no measure, no differentiation, no individual. Life would have no means to call attention to significant features, essential characteristics, to respond to stimulus. It is the distance between that determines the influence, whether a variable is close enough to be felt or too far away to be noticed. With all that chatter going on, sustaining interaction and exchange, it is no wonder human beings are social creatures. And in the end, after a gesture is perceived, a feeling is felt. It is the emotional aspect that drives motivation, influences our actions, colors life with a thrill of adventure, curiosity to explore, silliness to play. When proximities are considered in architecture, form and space are tuned to the senses, heightened emotional experiences. It is the nuance in gesture that holds the precision. A precise, so precise, any variation in attraction is absent. It happens in a fraction, so quickly consciousness cannot keep up, or so slowly only the subconscious can make sense of it. We simply feel the impact, not aware how. This is the space in which proximics happens. So with that, we'll pick up next week with the manifesto.
Thank you.
Thanks.